So David, thank you very much for coming through to the museum today. You're our first live guest on the podcast. Everyone else has been recorded at distance throughout the COVID pandemic. So it's very nice to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in.
Pleasure.
And we're going to be doing a kind of a short conversation based around what would have been a talk delivered at the museum. So obviously we won't quite be covering the depth and breadth of the information that was in your talk, and it's from the notes I've read through, a very fascinating subject and something that we probably won't do justice to today. But we're going to be talking about the contribution of the Commonwealth soldiers, or perhaps more the Empire at the time in the First World War, and particularly around the Royal Fusiliers.
Yes, it's an interesting period because, as you say, it's Commonwealth or Empire, it's attitudes of the time, it's how people felt about the Empire, both those who were abroad looking back at Britain and those in Britain seeing about those abroad. And,
yeah.
and the fascination is the way in which both looked at each other fondly, but there was still a very strong colour bar. And so the issues that come through, if we look at them through today's lens, are quite difficult sometimes to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of getting yourself into the mindset of 1914, which is very different from that of where we are now.
Of course. So perhaps though you could just paint a little bit of a picture about what the British Army looked like at the start of August 1914, kind of numbers, where people were perhaps based around the Empire.
Yeah, I mean, the British Army in 1914 consisted of about 250,000 full-time soldiers, and that was it. And it wasn't huge by any means. And half of the army was overseas. So you had, most regiments had three battalions, one battalion always overseas, a second battalion at home training, and a third battalion that was the reserve battalion. And the Royal Fusiliers was a little bit different because they actually had seven battalions, potentially. But in 1914, the first battalion was in Ireland, the second battalion was in India, based on Calcutta, the third battalion was also in India, based on Lucknow. Fourth battalion was at Parkhurst on the Isle of Wight. Five and six were the reserve battalions in Hounslow and Dover. And then they had this very strange battalion called the 7th Royal Fusiliers Special Reserve. And they were the men who'd done their full-time service but were serving in the reserve, but were on immediate call-up. So on the 4th of August, they were called up, and my grandfather was one of them. His son was born on the 4th of August, but he was on his way to Falmouth Docks whilst his wife was in labour with my uncle. So they were immediately mobilised and sent off to Falmouth, and then they became another reserve battalion who were sent out. The situation was you had about 130,000 men available immediately against a German army potentially of something like 800,000. So that you had a huge difference between what was available and what was ready, and the panic was, where do we get these extra men from?
And this is presumably where we're all very familiar with the Lord Kitchener poster, "Your country needs you," and he's actually dotted around the floor of our museum at the moment as part of our social distancing your country needs you slogan in use again. So he makes the call out for volunteers. Where do these volunteers come from?
A lot of them came from Britain. There was an immediate response, and a lot of men, particularly obviously the younger men, put themselves forward. Our duty to the country, our duty to support. We know we're in difficulties, but we believe the rightness of this conflict. So the 100,000 volunteers he got initially, but the message went out overseas as well, and there were men all over what was the Empire in Australia, Sri Lanka, India, Argentina, Malta, Myanmar, Canada, who said, right, I've got to go back to the home country. And that's how they viewed it, even if they were second generation. We'll go back to the home country, we will volunteer. And they turned up in England, usually Liverpool or Southampton. And the arrangement was that if you came across and signed on within 48 hours of your arrival, mm-hmm. And then joined a regiment, went off, fought the war, survived the war, you'd get your passage home paid and your outward passage reimbursed. So there was a deal if you survived, but it was a bit of a gamble. But that was the arrangement. And you had a situation where groups of men came over. I found one group who came to join the Royal Fusiliers from Myanmar, from Burma. Mm-hmm. And they'd been recruited by the local military attaché, sent first class on a mail ship across, dealt with by Thomas Cook Travel. They had a hotel booked in London, and within 24 hours of their arrival, they'd signed on to the Royal Fusiliers, because that was a regiment in London that was recruiting. And the arrangement was that you turned up, you signed on, you were allocated, and then the Royal Fusiliers would place you in the battalion. Mm-hmm. And it depended where they were up to in the battalions, which one you got. So quite a lot of them went into the first battalion they rose was the 10th, the Stockbrokers Battalion. So you had quite a few overseas men volunteering, turning up in London, St. Paul's Churchyard, often the recruiting office, and sent, joined the 10th Fusiliers, they're in Colchester, and off they went. Others were put into the Public Schools Battalion, the Sportsman's Battalion, and then you had this very strange group called the Frontiersmen, and that's really where the story for the Frontiersmen starts in 1915.
Yeah, I found this the story of the Frontiersmen when I was doing a little bit of the research really quite fascinating. And I thought we could maybe expand a little bit from the Legion of Frontiersmen and how that kind of feeds in and the process and the recruitment of these men and sort of where they came from as well.
An interesting group, and I found them because I was researching through the battalions just to find a bit about the history of them, and this group popped up as the 25th Battalion. And the Frontiersmen themselves were only 9 years old as an organisation. So they founded in 1905 by a chap called Roger Pocock, who was an ex-Northwest Mountain policeman in Canada. Been a Klondike explorer, a Boer War soldier, and he was attracting men to keep the frontiers quiet, lest affairs of outposts give the Kaiser excuse for picking a quarrel. And the idea was that you had these empire men who were prepared to stand up for the empire in various dark corners of strange countries that were well away from the British. If you are a good man of good character who can shoot, working in Britain or elsewhere in the world, and are prepared to rally to the support of the country in the event of a crisis. So it was a sort of dad's army group who would come together, had certain skills, and they were going to come together and defend the empire. And on the declaration of war, the Legion cut into operation, and in some countries like New Zealand, Canada, Australia, you actually had a Frontiersman battalion in the local army because there were enough of them there. A lot of them got frustrated and said, no, we'll go back to Britain and join up in Britain. So you had people sort of, one chap, Buchanan, was counting flowers around the Hudson's Bay area. Mm-hmm. As part of a government survey, he heard about this war breaking out and thought, my duty is to get home. Well, it took him till Christmas to get back to Ottawa, and then he had to come across the Atlantic, and by about January he was back in England, and by February he'd joined up and had caught up with the rest of the Frontiersmen, and they were forming this battalion. The War Office was a little uncertain about the sort of organisation and about Colonel Driscoll, who was the man who was going to set them up. Because they were a very strange, almost a cowboy organisation. You know, you come, you sign up, and we'll get you across to France to do the fighting. And it wasn't quite the way the army was working at the time. So they had to work with Colonel Driscoll to control, really, what he was trying to do. But he was certainly attracting a lot of people, some of whom joined other battalions. And certainly I found some frontiersmen in the 10th Battalion, a couple of big game hunters. But the 25th was formed in February of 1915. So it was into the war, but they were abroad by April. And it was the only battalion sent abroad without any extensive training in Britain first.
So they probably got back overseas quicker than many of them had gotten back to Britain from wherever they were originally posted.
Straight across, yes. It was, 23rd of April, there they were on the station at Waterloo and off on the boat to Africa.
You mentioned Buchanan up in northern Canada, and you kind of alluded to them being a bit of a kind of cowboy mob, and I certainly imagine them as members of this collection of probably sometimes quite wild looking frontiersmen. So there must have been some tremendously interesting characters, if that's the nicest way to phrase it. Involved in the frontiersmen. So any ones in particular that kind of jump off the page, that they are the people who kind of spawn the legends?
Well, there was one chap who was 64, been a big game hunter in Africa, had developed quite a reputation. He joined up. He had to argue quite strongly as to why he should be allowed in the army when the aim was, yep, age limit was 45 and he was 64. Others at a similar end of the age range had been turned up and filled in their attestation forms, their signing on forms, and put on the fact that there were 50 or 52 or 53, and the recruiting sergeant looked at the form and said, would you like to come back when you're younger? Which is the opposite of the usual tale, yeah. Is would you like to come back when you're older? So you had people of 50, 55 joining, but they had the experience, they had the skills. And somebody who joined the battalion later wrote a letter home, which was said the lines of the few Bloemfontein and Bulawayo, and then went to Argentina as a commercial traveller for Johnny Walker. Another one, after the Boer War, went into the glass trade in Paris and fought during the first 6 months of the war with the French Foreign Legion. One came over from the furthest west and can talk with equal confidence on bridge building in Alaska and the trappers of northern Canada, although he started his career as an engineer on a tramp steamer that potted around India in the east. One was in the neighbourhood of Lake Nyasa after Ivory when the war broke out. And when a mail came in, if I had nothing to read, I could choose between the Grimsby Herald, the Los Angeles Daily Times, the Melbourne Weekly Chronicle, or the Calcutta Advocate. And when the battalion was first raised, it must have been without doubt one of the most remarkable collections of men that was ever got together. And there's lists of countries that they came from: Honolulu, Hong Kong, China, Ceylon, Malay States, India, New Zealand, Australia, South and East Africa, Egypt, South America, Mexico, USA, Canada. So a real polyglot of characters, hunters, stockmen, farmers, traders, fishermen, sailors, ship's cooks, rubber plantation managers. Huge mix, strange mix, but really a cohesive together. And they were said to be unusual because they would only accept an officer if the officer proved themselves to be good as a leader. So they weren't like drilled soldiers who would accept authority. They accepted authority when authority proved itself worthy of being accepted. So it must have been a tough bunch to work with.
Yeah, that's a really interesting kind of democratic line to explore, perhaps on another day.
Yeah,
because it's a very big topic to unpick. But it strikes me very much that sitting here in Eastriggs, that bears the moniker, the Commonwealth Village, from all the people who came from around the Commonwealth to work here in the factory, that the Royal Fusiliers, and particularly the Frontiersmen, really could share in that moniker of being from the Commonwealth, from the Empire, from yes. all the different regions of
the Yeah, and
from.
I mean, it's interesting looking at the streets around Eastrigg, because you've got Australia, you've got Canada, mm-hmm. you've got South Africa. What you haven't got is the Caribbean. You've got Singapore Street,
yep.
but there are certain bits that are missing, and that's exactly the same issue that they had in the British Army, that certain countries were immediately accepted. Others in the world equally keen to support were not as acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So the 25th Fusiliers had very few black faces in them.
Yeah.
It was mainly the ex-Empire men who had come across. But the British Army was drawing from elsewhere in the Empire.
Well, great, David. I know we've only touched on a very small quantity of everything that you would have talked about had been able to give your talk in the museum today. So I just want to set aside the last couple of minutes of our podcast today for anything that we've perhaps missed. I'm aware that we've missed quite a lot in the story. But if there's any particular points or any particular topics that you wanted, just have a couple of minutes just to really emphasise and share with our listeners.
The big difference was that the 25th Battalion out in Africa fought a war unlike the conflict in France. There were no trenches. They were on trek. They were travelling from place to place. It was very much like the Chindits in the Second World War against the Japanese. They were going through the bush, through the jungle, to get behind the German lines, to capture the German holdings, push them back. The causes of their death were many and various, but they mostly died of disease. And whereas against the whole British Army, where I think it was 13% died of disease, over half, 55% of 25 RF died of disease. Malaria particularly took them out. So the contrast they had, and there's books written about the battalion, and after about 18 months they're saying there's only 30 or 40 men left of the original 1,200. Because the rest had all either died or were so sick with malaria that they'd been shipped out, taken home and replaced. Mm-hmm. And many of them were brought back to England. Some of them survived, but many of them didn't. The other interesting thing is that many of those who did survive the malaria were the ones who'd been out in Africa as big game hunters or traders. Many of those who died were men from England who'd been in the Frontiersmen, but had been a warm cotton worker or a cotton worker or a wool worker in Lancashire or Yorkshire. And they obviously didn't have the immunity to the malaria. So a lot of them were those who suffered really badly. And there is one theory that the old hands who were from that East Africa area knew the best way to avoid it was keep your shirt sleeves down. But in that heat, you're stripped off. So you were open to the malarial mosquito getting you. Hence the high death rate. And it really was quite a contrast, and the way in which they suffered and went on. And they'd only be there for 3 months and they were laid low with malaria and shipped out. It was a pretty horrible war to be in. And again, pretty well forgotten, a bit like the Japanese war in Burma. So an interesting bunch, really came together to do a job, really dedicated to what they were doing, quite well led, had some successes, quite a lot of successes, but had a pretty horrific time.
Gosh, it's such a fascinating story of what these men did and went through and things like that, and I'm really glad we could at least in some form share part of your talk today David Carter, thank you very, very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Devil's Porridge Museum podcast. Remember, you can catch up on previous pods through our website, and keep checking our social media for updates on new podcast releases.